Good day, and welcome to the DAE Investor Relations conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. For your information, there will be a Q&A session at the end of the presentation. Should you wish to pose a question, please press star one at any time. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to your host today, Sinan Kayhan, Director of Corporate Development. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Sarah. Good morning and good afternoon. My name is Sinan Kayhan, Director of Corporate Development, and I'm responsible for fixed income investor relations. Welcome to the conference call to discuss DAE's results for the 6 months ended 30 June 2018. I would also like to emphasize that our discussion today will include statements which are not historical facts, but instead may be deemed forward-looking statements. Forward-looking statements affect our current expectations regarding future events, results, or outcomes. Those expectations may or may not be realized for any number of reasons, many of which are beyond our control, which could materially affect our financial condition, results of operations, and cash flow. The call will be recorded and a replay will be available on our website. There will be two speakers today, Firoz Karapore, our CEO, and Jennifer Creevy, our CFO. After the speakers' remarks, there will be a question and answer session. I will now hand you over to Firoz to provide an overview of our performance.
Thank you, Sinan, and welcome to everybody to our first half 2018 earnings call. I think you all have seen the numbers which we announced relatively early this morning. We put the presentation up at the same time. What I'm going to do is principally focus my comments on page 3 and then turn it over to Jennifer for the rest of the presentation, and then we'll both come back for Q&A at the end of it. So if you'd kindly turn your attention to page 3, let me just start off by saying what is obvious in the release, that the first half for us was a very, very strong a period characterized both by strong kind of financial and operating performance. Jennifer will take us through the numbers in detail, but at the very headline levels, you know, revenue of $711 million, which puts us on the $1.4 billion run rate that we had described to you for those of us who we've been discussing since the last year, so that, you know, now we have enough data points to kind of validate the run rate levels that we have been saying all along for our business. Pre-tax profit, $224 million, which includes some trading gains. Those are all disclosed in the financials, and that makes up a pre-tax profit margin of 31.5%. That was roughly the same number that came through in the second quarter numbers as well, which are in the bondholders' report. It was 31.8. So, you know, the business is kicking up at a pretty good rate. And at the same time, we're also seeing credit metrics and liquidity metrics, which continue to improve. So, again, net debt to equity, which is the way we look at our principal leverage metric, and I know that some of the agencies have a slightly different definition, et cetera, down to just below 3, you know, a whisker, down from 3.20 at the end of 2017. And I think, again, for those of you who have been with us since we issued the bonds in August of last year, we said that by December of this year, we'd be very comfortably below 3. So we're well on our way to do that, and internal projections show that we should be able to meet that commitment as well. And our available liquidity, which again defined traditionally as the industry defines it, is about $1.5 billion. Our fleet composition, not that much changed, 56% narrow bodies, 37% wide bodies. And again, for those of you who've been there call after call, a big portion of that is our 777 freighters. And then 7% is our only non-jet asset, ATR 72-600. Our regional composition has changed a little bit. Miasa is now up to 38%. Asia-Pacific is down to about 29%. Europe and Americas continue to remain kind of where they were. The principal reason for the change is as we put new aircraft in, a lot of the wide bodies are going into the region, into the Miasa region, and as we divest aircraft, some of the narrow body divestitures are coming out of the Asia Pacific region. So that's, I think, the headline driver for the difference. We've all kinds of data behind this. Jennifer will will walk us through that shortly. And again, from a customer and a country count perspective, relatively stable, 110 customers in 56 countries. So pretty broad, pretty diversified from our perspective. Credit rating, I think all of you have most likely seen that S&P upgraded our corporate ratings to BB+ on the back of a successful integration exercise that we did, and, of course, on the back of strong performance that we see through the numbers. Moody's, at approximately the same time, changed the outlook to positive. And if you read the Moody's press release about what could make the rating go higher, all of the things that they have identified are things that are on our to-do list anyway. So on that one, I would say stay tuned, but the goalposts are pretty much in our line of sight at this point. Whilst we're on ratings, let me just step back and make kind of a broader kind of overall point. I would say that today, you know, we have a very good kind of liquidity and rate profile. But I think that at this scale and at the scale of our ambitions, which is obviously higher than this, it is relatively straightforward to us that we do need investment-grade ratings to ensure that our liquidity pool is properly aligned to the size that we want to take our business to. Now, you know, as all of you know, that is not entirely within our control as to when we kind of get there or whether we get there or not. But off of the things that we can do to get there, meaning capital structure flexibility, stronger alternate liquidity, conservative leverage, all of those we will continue to do as a matter of priority, because getting to that particular outcome is important to us as we think about what our liability side and our capital structure looks like. Now, how quickly that translates into investment grade ratings, you know, we will have to, of course, wait and defer to our colleagues at the rating agencies to make their own conclusions and their analysis. And there are certain things we can't control, but those that we can, our internal path will be quite straightforward to where we need to be and then some. I want to make a comment or two on the trading environment that we see for aircraft, which continues to remain very, very strong. Again, as a reminder, in 2016 and 2017, neither legacy company did a lot of divestitures for obvious reasons, but we said that we would be on a very steady path starting with 2018. So this year, we announced the sale of a 16-aircraft portfolio in May. That is now beginning to come through in terms of novations and gains. But you should expect from us a very steady divestiture activity that stretches multiple years, short of course, the market environment changing, and that market environment is either a price environment or the liquidity environment. So short of that changing, divestitures are a part of our very broad kind of corporate strategy, and we will stay on that path kind of independent of what happens on the order side of things, which is what I want to touch upon next. For those of you, again, who have been on our calls in the past, we've made a comment about our OEM discussions. We have been making comments about that since August of last year. But at this point, I have to say that whilst the discussions are ongoing with the OEMs, the current disconnect between rental levels and purchase prices is just unsustainable from our perspective, which means that we cannot see any value in committing capital, and by that we mean large amounts of capital, at these levels where expected IRRs are kind of mediocre to something that we would not even contemplate as passing our threshold. So I think we continue our discussions, we monitor the market, and our first priority still is to try and get something done directly with the OEMs. But at this point, the disconnect has lasted for a very long period of time, and we don't know the future well enough to know how this is going to kind of unravel. I also wanted to make one comment on our business focus, which is very, very important from our perspective. In May, if you look at our media section, the press releases, we promoted one of our very young, talented executives to the newly created position of president. And the purpose here was to focus on integrated decision-making as it relates to how we originate, how we trade, how we add value through our technical function, which for us as a lifecycle lessor is a very, very important contributor of value, and our newly created business, which is our third-party asset management business, AIS. And that business focus is paying off in a very nice way, and you should expect us to kind of work on this structure even more and make it even more effective for our company, because we're running a $14, $15 billion enterprise, and on the other hand, we are planning for that enterprise to be of significantly greater size. So the business focus now is a very important part of how we run our company going forward. Let me make one last comment on our financing activity. In May of this year, we announced a very large, up to $800 million unsecured revolving credit facilities that was originated all from the region, which is, again, underscores the unique access that we have to both liquidity and capital as DAE. And that added considerably to the financing flexibility that we have on the balance sheet. And post-Labor Day in the U.S., we will evaluate, subject to market conditions, whether we come out with a 144A or a Sukuk or something that further takes us to where we need to be in terms of our capital structure. So let me pause here, and let me turn it over to Jennifer, and then we will come back at the end for Q&A.
Thank you, Feroz. Slide 4 provides a more detailed analysis of our fleet. At the end of June, our fleet consisted of 375 aircraft, split 317 owned aircraft, 40 managed aircraft, and 18 committed aircraft with a total value of $14.2 billion. We are split between 84% passenger aircraft and 16% freighter aircraft based on net book value. Our fleet is very well balanced, 44% Airbus, 49% Boeing, and 7% ATR, also based on net book value. Within our deliveries during the first half of the year, we delivered our first Boeing MAX aircraft. At the end of June, our fleet age was 6.1 years, and our average remaining lease term was also 6.1 years. And total fleet utilization was 99.7%. Moving now to slide 5, which shows an analysis of our customers in further detail. Our largest region is Miasa at 38%, and this is an increase from the previous quarter due to the items that Feroz mentioned earlier, due to the fact that we have sold some aircraft within the fleet, and we also have some new aircraft coming in to this region. Our largest customer is still Emirates at 15% of total fleet value at the end of June, followed by Ethiopian Airlines. Our top 10 customers account for approximately 38% of our fleet. And as the slide shows, we are very well diversified across the globe, with 110 customers in 56 countries. Moving to slide 6, which shows our income statement for the half year to June 2018 compared to June 2017. Overall, total comprehensive income for the period was $199.8 million compared to $47 million. The primary reason for this increase was due to the acquisition of AWOS by DAE in August 2017, which led to increased revenue in 2018, and also there were additional gains on sales of aircraft during the period. The number of owned aircraft, as previously mentioned, was 317 at the end of June 2018 and was 83 at the end of June 2017. And this increase in fleet size is the primary reason for the variance of most lines within the P&L. Profit before tax of $224 million compared to $42.6 million in June 2017 gives a pre-tax profit margin of 31.5%. Our adjusted EBITDA for the first half of the year was $658.6 million, compared to $182.2 million in 2017. This gives an adjusted EBITDA margin of 92.6%, which is up from 90% at the end of Q1 2018. To talk briefly on the quarter, the overall comprehensive income for the 3 months to the end of June 2018 was $101.2 million, compared to $17.3 million in Q2 2017. Now looking at revenue in further detail on slide 7. Our total revenue has increased to $711.4 million compared to $228.7 million at the end of June last year. And this was due to the significant number of additional aircraft in the fleet. In addition, since the start of the year, DAE have purchased 15 aircraft in 2018. Total lease revenue was $675.6 million compared to $202 million in June 2017. Maintenance revenue has increased due to releases on transitioning aircraft and also maintenance timing releases period on period. To note, 87.5% of our lease revenue is fixed, and our top five customers based on lease revenue represent 28.6% of our revenue. Moving now to expenses on slide 8. Overall, our expenses for the half year were $332.2 million compared to $130.6 million in the prior year. The main item within expenses is depreciation and amortization costs, and this has increased in the half year to 2018 due to the increased number of aircraft. General and admin expenses have also increased to $44.5 million compared to $14.1 million. This was due to additional costs relating to the increased number of staff in the group and also costs following the acquisitions. General and admin costs as a percentage of revenue was 6.3% at the end of June 2018. In the first half of 2018, we also had gains on disposal of aircraft of $18.5 million compared to a loss in 2017. The gain relates to the sale of 8 aircraft. Within this aircraft sale, 5 of these aircraft relate to the portfolio sale of aircraft that we announced at the end of May 2018. And to recap, this transaction was for a portfolio of 16 aircraft worth $900 million. There are a further 11 aircraft yet to sell within this portfolio, and 3 of which have yet to deliver. Moving to slide 9, where we look at our financing costs in further detail. Net finance costs have increased to $155 million from $56 million in June 2017. This reflects the larger debt balances, which have increased to $10.3 billion at the end of June 2018 compared to $2.6 billion in June 2017, and higher interest costs at the end of the half year. This increase was partially offset by higher finance income arising from unrealised gains on mark-to-market of $18.5 million and breakage gains of $10.8 million due to early debt repayments. Our average cost of debt at the end of June 2018 was 4.2%, and our weighted average debt maturity is 5.5 years. As mentioned, our overall debt was just under $10.3 billion at the end of June. 57% of this debt is recourse, 26% is unsecured, which includes the drawn revolving credit facilities, and 14% was non-recourse. 252 aircraft provide collateral against our loan facilities, and we have 65 unencumbered aircraft in the fleet with a net book value of $1.6 billion. Our revolving credit facilities at the end of June were $1.2 billion, with $346 million of these drawn, and our total available liquidity is $1.5 billion. Net debt to equity has again improved, and it's now just under 3 times, at 2.99 times, compared to 3.20 at the end of 2017. Our debt on a geographical basis is very well diversified, with 30% coming from the Europe region, 26% from EASA, and with Americas and Asia just over the 20% mark. Looking at our balance sheet now in further detail on slide 10, total assets for the group were just under $15.5 billion, slightly up on the year end. And our total equity for DAE has increased to $3.4 billion due to the additional profit that has been generated by the group in this period. I will now hand back to Feroz for some closing remarks.
I think just to, in the interest of time, on a wonderful Friday in August, we'll go straight to Q&A if there is any.
Certainly. Thank you, sir. If you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is switched off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, please press star 1 to ask a question. We'll now move to our first question, which comes from Mark Street of JP Morgan. Please go ahead, sir.
Yes, good day, everyone. And, Rose, you had mentioned your comments about the economics of new orders today. Several of your large leasing peers have certainly talked about how the sale-leaseback market is still very inefficient from the standpoint of a return perspective and so forth, and its returns have been whittled down there from all the money out of Asia and so forth. But we haven't really seen any leasing CEOs with such a strong sort of indictment of the returns of new orders and new order book. And I'm wondering, you know, certainly because when we talk to Air Lease, we talk to AerCap, we talk to Avalon, et cetera, SMBC, BOC, et cetera, they're all talking about the returns that they're able to generate, the favorable returns from that new order book. And I'm wondering, is that more a function of sort of their legacy orders? Because they're all continuing to sort of top up orders as well, or is it unique to DAE in terms of your size or just where you are in terms of those relationships? I'm wondering if you can expand on that a little bit more because I'm a little confused.
Yeah, sure. Happy to do that. So, Mark, I think that, first of all, you know, we don't know all of the numbers, but if we had to speculate, I would put my finger on two principal factors that contribute to us not being able to get there where others might. First is that, you know, these orders were placed in a different era and with a different scale. So, you know, ALC, Steve, John, et cetera, have a different relationship. Their associations are far deeper than either of our legacy companies have been. An AerCap scale is totally different. So that does play a role. Their PAs are more embedded, deeper, et cetera, et cetera. And they do a lot of launch customer stuff, which comes with different pricing, which historically we've not been able to do because neither company had the ability to do that. And I think the second reason is cost of funds. Both of them are IG. They trade at a slightly different, more than a slightly different level at which we trade. So I think when you put those two things together and apply our normal kind of 3-to-1 debt to equity in this business, there are certain things that they would find or the same thresholds they could get there because of lower metal price and lower cost of funding that we, at this point, can't. And also, I think we are relatively conservative. So whilst an order book today requires a commitment of at least 6 to 8 years into the future, based on the last 8 to 20 years of history, we're unwilling to underwrite lease rental inflation in the way that the capital commitment would imply.
So just let me follow up on that then. So how do you grow then? Because I'm sure you agree that, you know, the 0.5 or 0.6, you know, lease rate factors in the sale leaseback market is not attractive either. So, you know, and I think about in terms of your desire to get to investment grade and further diversifying, getting the Emirates exposure down a little bit, the rating agencies would like to see that, et cetera. So that implies a level of growth. And I'm just sort of wondering, you know, what is the game plan then for DE? Because I really like the story. I like what you're doing in terms of getting the leverage down, you know, talking about getting to investment grade. But I'm sort of just curious a little bit more for the mileposts and the steps that you need to take to get there, given the fact that you're not really going to actively pursue a new order book at this point.
Right. So I think that's an excellent question, Mark, and that's a question that if you were to peek into our inside list of questions is right at the top in terms of how we're going to solve for that. Now, let me first be very upfront and say that we don't have a crisp and clear answer. But we do know exactly where we need to get to. So just in terms of frames of reference here, we are going to put on $1.8 billion-ish of new business in 2018. This is, again, without all the stuff that we just talked about. And that, in part, was because of the smallish pipeline order that AWAS had, but also in part because of the 110-plus customer relationships that we have, which result in different outcomes. So I think that for us, we are We are in the process of sorting that out. And whilst there is a plan B and plan C, and I'll kind of be intentionally coy about that a little bit on this phone call, let me reiterate that plan A still is to see if we can square the circle between new orders and the underwriting assumptions that we otherwise make as part of that. But growth for us is our biggest kind of how are we going to get there with some degree of certainty question that we wrestle with.
Okay, great. That's helpful. And then just a question on financing, my final question. You mentioned Sukuk, and you have access to your shareholders to a market that other lessors don't necessarily have. So I'm just sort of wondering, as you look at, you know, further unencumbering the balance sheet, building up unencumbered assets, and, you know, that's clearly one of the steps you need to take to get to investment grade, how do you determine 144A versus, you know, something more local to your shareholder like the Sukuk market, you know, in terms of your overall cost of funding and how you manage that mix?
I think, as we have always said, that we solve for two things as quantitatively as we can, but by definition, some of it is qualitative. One is the sheer cost of accessing through a particular channel, and then the appropriate number of channels so that we have a fully diversified sort of profile at the end of the day. So, you know, like for like, we'll develop both channels. If the economics are in favor of one, of course, we'll favor that. But it's a TBD. But again, you know, I use this phrase internally. Don't take it literally. But again, if we had a magic wand, we would do a large amount in both markets with the appropriate maturity staggering so that we could develop both of those channels further.
Great. Thanks very much. Appreciate the time.
No worries.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll now move to our next question from Russell Filipski of Post Advisory. Please go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to follow up on Mark's question a little bit, just on the, like, spread economics of the OEM aircraft relative to doing a sale leaseback. Is there, like, I don't know, big picture, is there a way to textualize, like, kind of maybe what the lease yield, you know, benefit is to doing a sale leaseback, you know, given just the unfavorable economics of placing an OEM order? Does that make sense?
Well, kind of. So, Russell, the way we think about life is that if the returns do not meet thresholds, it's silly for us to just deploy capital just to keep ourselves busy. In theory, we should return the capital and let somebody else deal with it on a better way. But in terms of relative returns, I think that we do everything on a IRR basis. And at this point, I would say that that PLBs, that both of them right now don't meet any threshold. So it's a hard analysis at the moment.
Right. And you know, putting in an upfront kind of placement order to Boeing or Airbus when you're not going to get the plane in 68 years is also kind of like a misuse of capital you're also suggesting, right?
So let's put that in perspective. And I think, as we have said on prior occasions, we're not building a short-term business. We're building a very long-term, hopefully a very successful and very large business. So securing long-term growth is a good thing from our perspective, as long as our underwriting is stringent enough to anticipate that life 6 or 8 years out is something that, you know, is very little visibility on at the moment.
Got it. And then when you talk about just adding, you know, over $1 billion in new revenue, you know, how much of that is coming from, you know, the aircraft that, you know, are in your pipeline from a commitment standpoint, right? You have plus or minus 20 aircraft coming you know, being delivered to you? Like, I would imagine it's a smaller amount, but I just wanted to kind of break down how you guide us to that, you know, incremental revenue growth.
Right. So I think the reference I made earlier was to $1.8 billion in 2018. If memory serves me correctly, if I'm wrong, one of us will get back to you with the exact numbers. Is it about 15 of the 23 aircraft that legacy AWOS had on order will deliver this year? One, I think, might be slipping to next year, something like that. These are all narrow bodies, so you can kind of get an estimate of that aggregate value, and then the rest is through PLB commitments that we had made both on the legacy DAE side and on the legacy AWOS side. 2019, of course, there is virtually nothing in terms of pipeline for obvious reasons, a very small number. And so the most of them will come through customer opportunities.
And all the aircraft scheduled for delivery to you, they're all placed through 2019?
Yeah, all of the pipeline aircraft are placed, and on the portfolio aircraft, so this is the stuff that's already on the books that otherwise has a maturity or something like that in 2019, we have 30 of those, 19 of them are placed, and 11 are yet to be placed, and there's line of sight on all 11, and they should all be documented maybe in the next 2 months.
Okay, and then last question, the $300 million bond repurchase program that you announced subsequent to quarter end, you obviously purchased some debt during the quarter, but the majority of it was purchased after June 30. Is the 24 bond still the preference bond, or have you been buying any other bonds since, you know, that announcement?
Right. So I think that we look at it every day on a relative value basis. The 2024s have been offering pretty decent value, so the bulk of our repurchases have been off the 2024s. There is a tiny piece of the 2022s, but
yeah.
Decision metric is every day, see what's offering the best value, and obviously the 2020s don't make any sense at this point.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now move to our next question from Gary Leibovitz of Wells Fargo. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, operator. Faraz, I was hoping maybe you can, it seems like, you know, traffic is very strong, but in the last few weeks we've had, you know, concerns about trade wars or currency movements, labor issues. Maybe you can talk about your customer watch list and what you're seeing happening at the top of the watch list, and, you know, which geographies have you most concerned in the near term. Thank you.
Okay, Gary, hi. You saw the IATA numbers yesterday for July. We've seen we see what fuel pricing has done to P&Ls in the first 6 months or so. Of course, as we all know, there is a little bit of a lag. Broadly speaking, I think we're not that worried about fuel prices relative to the strength that we see in demand, et cetera. From a watch list perspective, if you look at the countries where we have exposure, none of them are really so this is the list is on the top right of page 5. None of them are really that troublesome to us from a credit perspective. We have individual names. Again, these are story-related things where individual items are going on. None of them are out of kilter. We watch, and I say this word, not in the credit watch sense, but we watch with interest what's going on in Turkey, because the currency continues to tumble a lot. And we do have aircraft in Turkey, and we hope that that situation stabilizes. I think that we have seen now that the Russian currency where it is and the Indian rupee where it is, that doesn't seem to have a big enough impact. So from our perspective, I think there is nothing that's of, kind of flashing red at the moment. There's, quite a few ambers that we continue to watch, but those are, I think, same quantum, I should say, of ambers that we've been watching in the recent past.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That concludes today's Q&A session. I'd now like to turn the call back to Mr. Faraz Terapore for any additional or closing remarks. Thank you.
Okay, terrific. Thank you, operator. And listen, guys, thanks again for taking time on this wonderful Friday in August. Enjoy the rest of your summer, and we'll see you in 3 months' time.
Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect, ladies and gentlemen.